Welcome to Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers with New York Times best-selling authors Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge. In this episode, part two of Bad Blood, Casey Sherman's acclaimed true crime novel about freedom and death in the White Mountains. And stay tuned at the end of this episode for a new track from blues legend James Montgomery, written and recorded exclusively for this podcast. And now, Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge.
May 11th, 2007. In the shadow of the fallen old man of the mountain, on a lonely stretch of mountain road, two men lay dead. A spasm of violence that took only a few minutes to play out has left a community divided and searching for answers. It was supposed to be a routine traffic stop over an expired car registration, but there were years of bad blood flowing between a young man named Leeko Kenny and a Franconia, New Hampshire police officer named Bruce McKay. On this fateful day, McKay rammed his police SUV into the grill of Leeko's gray Toyota Celica. He then leapt out of his vehicle and pepper sprayed the young man through the driver's side window. Within a fraction of a second, Leeko retaliated, pulling out a .45 high-caliber semi-automatic pistol out from under his car seat and opening fire on McKay, striking him four times. And the drama did not end there. Leeko then drove his car into the officer at full speed.
Watching this violence unfold was a U.S. Marine named Greg Floyd. Floyd jumped out of his own truck, grabbed McKay's pistol off the ground, and shot Leeko Kenny dead. Leeko's best friend and passenger, Caleb McCauley, prayed the next bullet would not be for him. Here, in an interview with police that night, Caleb describes what happened.
Did you handle a firearm at all today?
I did not. The guy who picked up Officer McKay's gun and shot the driver, my friend, told me, after he, like I said, I ducked, but he was like, pick up the gun. I'm like, sir, I'm not going to pick up the gun. You're going to shoot me if I pick up the gun. So I did not touch any weapon whatsoever.
He told you to pick up what gun?
He told me to pick up my friend's .45 out of his dead hands.
Caleb finally got out of the Celica and sat on the ground with his arms raised. At that point, Greg Floyd looked into the vehicle at Leeko's bloody, lifeless body slumped over in the driver's seat. Oh, I shot him good, Floyd said, smiling. Floyd now had both McKay's and Leeko's weapons in his hands. When police arrived, one of the officers yelled to him, drop the fucking guns! Floyd didn't flinch. Easy, son, I'm a quicker draw than you. Finally, the Marine veteran placed both guns on the ground and was ordered by the police officer to step back.
At that moment, one of the EMTs noticed the pant leg of Bruce McKay's uniform sticking out from under the car. He's still alive, the EMT yelled. McKay's body was under the Toyota Celica between the tires, parallel to the front bumper. The full weight of the vehicle appeared to be resting on his broken body. The EMT checked his pulse. It was slow and weak, but it was there. We gotta get this car off him, the EMT cried. Volunteers tried to push the car back, but it was still in gear and wouldn't budge. Finally, they reached through the broken glass of the driver's side and put the Celica in neutral and pushed it 3 feet back, revealing McKay's body. He had cuts to the face and hands. Both legs were spread apart, one of them folded back in an unnatural position. McKay's pelvis was shattered and the tip of his nose torn off. But those were what EMTs call distracting injuries. There was no blood or any foreign materials in his mouth, which was a good sign. They began chest compressions and were startled to find that McKay wasn't wearing a protective vest. Watching the EMTs try to save Bruce McKay's life, Greg Floyd said these words, he's fucked. The officer was then placed on a stretcher and taken to Littleton Regional Hospital, 11 miles away, where he was later pronounced dead.
The funeral for Franconia Police Corporal Bruce McKay was a massive spectacle of pomp and circumstance, as police officers from across the country came to the White Mountains to pay tribute to the fallen officer, one of their own. Through a steady stream of drizzle, they wept and remembered. New Hampshire's Attorney General Kelly Ayotte, a future United States Senator, praised the late officer. This once again reminds us of the difficult and dangerous work that is done every day by the law enforcement of this state to protect each of us, Ayotte said at a news conference. The police officers of this state, including Corporal McKay, are nothing short of heroes. Her assistant declared that McKay had only used a small amount of force, but nothing excessive in stopping Lee Kilkenny. Later, the release of the dashcam video would prove otherwise. Ayotte also had high praise for Lee Kilkenny's killer, Greg Floyd, whom she and other law enforcement officials elevated to superhero status. As the town laid McKay to rest, many also came out to the funeral service for his killer, Lee Kilkenny. Hundreds gathered in Franconia to mourn Lico. Many called him a good-hearted and spirited young man whose death was the result of a clash of cultures. But he was also remembered as a young man who loved his home, as he describes here in this interview.
Well, not everyone's nice in the North Country, but there's a lot of really giving people. I don't know anywhere else in the world where you can have so little and do so well. Like, I know people that came here 16 years ago with nothing. Nothing. Completely poor, completely homeless. And in 16 years, the North Country has taken them in and made them part of the community.
The blood feud between Lee Kilkenny and Officer Bruce McKay made national news, especially due to the fact that Lico's cousin, Bodie Miller, was the most famous skier in the world. Miller had also been pulled over by McKay in the past and feared him. Meanwhile, Lee Kilkenny's killer, Greg Floyd, relished in his newfound celebrity. After the shootings, Floyd waltzed into the Franconia Village store and announced, "I'm the guy who shot that kid."
And Dave, that's what drew me to this case. This was anything but your traditional police shooting, and had been presented to us in the media as a showdown between a bad kid and a hero cop before a good Samaritan came in and saved the day. That's when I decided to drive up to the North Country and investigate this case myself. I had so many questions about McKay, about Lico, and most importantly, about Greg Floyd. Was he the hero that everybody claimed he was? As I investigated Floyd's background, I made several startling revelations. First, Floyd had two felony drug convictions in the state of Georgia and had several prior run-ins with cops on his wooded property in eastern New Hampshire. Floyd had threatened his neighbors on several occasions, prompting police to execute a search warrant on his home where they found enough weapons to satisfy a small army. A meter reader was also terrified by Greg Floyd. "What the fuck are you doing here?" Floyd asked the man as he stepped out of his work truck. "Reading the meter as always," the man nervously replied. Floyd motioned to the growling German Shepherd by his side. "My dog is trained to attack the throat and the groin," he declared. "Do I need to kick your ass?" The meter reader fled the scene and returned later with the cops. "Why can't men be men?" Floyd said as he was being arrested for criminal threatening. "I want to take that pussy out into the woods and settle it in the mud and blood. If that pussy comes back, or if I see him again, I'll kill him." Then Floyd addressed the arresting officer. "I could have given you a third eye," he threatened.
On May 11, 2007, Lee Kilkenny's passenger, Caleb McCauley, stared into the crazed eyes of George Floyd for the very first time. Floyd had two guns trained on him. It's like he'd been waiting his whole life for this moment, for the opportunity to kill somebody and get away with it. The Marine veteran had never fought in a war. In fact, he had a pretty uneventful service record. He'd served in the Marines from 1976 to 1979 and received an honorable discharge. But Floyd had never served overseas and had no decorations or awards to show for his time in the service. But now he was starring in his own action movie where he could play the hero. Floyd had just gunned down a cop killer. Liko's dark blood was oozing out of his skull and covering the headrest of the Toyota Celica, but Floyd was itching to kill again.
When I was on the ground, this guy just started ranting like, "You better stay there." I was just emotional. I was crying. I was like, I couldn't believe what happened to what was going on. And the guy's like, "You better stop moving, stop crying." I'm like, "Sir," he's like, "I'm going to shoot you." And I'm like, "I have no weapons." He's like, "Well, I'm on medication, so it doesn't matter if you didn't have a weapon or not." And I don't know what that has to do. I'm just saying, like,
but that's what he said.
Exact quotes. And I swear on my life, I swear on my grandmother's life, that's exact quotes. I was scared for my life with this guy because he had the gun nonstop pointing at me.
After police arrived at the scene and secured Floyd's weapons, they asked him if he was okay. Floyd's response was nothing short of disturbing. "I kill for the government," he said. "This is my 43rd kill."
Dave, Greg Floyd had become a loaded weapon. Did he kill for the government? Nothing in his service record speaks to that. Caleb McCauley mentioned to police that Floyd said he was on medication. After the shootings, I uncovered Floyd's toxicology report from that day. I learned that he was also a diabetic and took insulin up to 5 times a day. He was also on 22 medications, including an antidepressant called Effexor. The combination of drugs made Floyd a prime candidate for serotonin syndrome, which caused hallucinations. Greg Floyd was now in full combat mode. The question burning through my mind was Liko Kenny murdered in cold blood? Now, there's no denying that Liko had killed Bruce McKay, but he should have been afforded a trial to defend himself, especially given McKay's years of intimidation towards him. But Liko was given a death sentence instead, while Attorney General Kelly Ayotte wasted no time, less than 24 hours, to determine that Greg Floyd was justified in killing Liko Kenny.
Meanwhile, debate was brewing over whether to honor Bruce McKay in New Hampshire. There was a bill before the state legislature calling for a portion of the Franconia Parkway to be renamed after the slain officer. Similar requests to honor fallen law enforcement officers had earned overwhelming support in the Granite State. But then the dashcam video of the deadly encounter was released to the media, and many of us realized that nothing was what it seemed. McKay's fiancée argued that he was killed in an untimely and brutal murder and that he should be remembered as a protector of community life. Liko's family called the proposal nothing but a stab in the back. State lawmakers eventually decided to shelve the idea.
I got behind the wheel of my Volkswagen Jetta and made the long trek from Boston to the North Country in search of answers. I passed the old man of the mountain, whose profile was now long gone. I drove to the site where Liko Kenny and Bruce McKay were killed. I bent down and ran my hand through the gravel and dirt. I could feel their presence. It was almost as if I could see their ghosts. I then drove to the bar in town, the Dutch Treat, where I knew I'd find people who had an opinion on this case. With Toby Keith blaring from the jukebox, I approached the crowded bar and ordered a beer. Hard men sat shoulder to shoulder, staring at their whiskey and peeling the labels off their beer bottles. I told everybody why I was there. A heavyset guy with a thick beard, wearing a trucker's hat, looked in my direction. "You've got no story here," he said, jabbing his chubby finger in my direction. "You got 3 assholes, and 2 of them are dead. End of fucking story." "I'm headed to Greg Floyd's place," I said. "He'll give you that third eye," the guy warned me. "He wants to be left alone, so let's leave him the fuck alone. You look like a nice fella. Floyd won't hesitate to blow your brains out. I probably should have listened. Instead, I finished my beer, got back in my car, and I drove.
Hey, Casey. Like our fans who tune in here on Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers, we're all about truth. Working on our projects, I need a boost sometimes. I love my coffee, but I'm really loving these true lifestyle drinks.
Me too, Dave. There are 6 different flavors for every activity. They're gluten and GMO-free, organic, vegan, and there's no artificial sweeteners or additives. They're clean, and they contain all sorts of vitamins and nutrients, and they're damn tasty.
You know, True's founder, Jack McNamara, is a former pro hockey player, and he created True because he was looking for healthy energy drinks that wouldn't make you crash. I've been loving Energy, the Orange Mango Wake Up Blend, as well as Focus, the Apple Kiwi Brain Blend. Jack and his team have scientifically engineered some game-changing beverages, and I'm working several of them into my daily routine.
And I'm making them part of my lifestyle, too. True Drinks for true crime fans. Go to drinktrue.com and use the code SAINTS to get 30% off your purchase. Now, back to Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers. The terrain was now one of dense woods, with trees so tall they nearly blocked out the sun. I truly felt alone. I hadn't seen a car pass for miles. I was entering the heart of darkness. I found Greg Floyd's compound tucked deep in the wilderness. I remembered Floyd's warning. My dog is trained to attack the throat and groin. Yet I continued on anyway. The dirt path leading to the house was long and winding. Throat and groin echoed in my mind. I heard the faint sound of a dog barking in the distance. Suddenly, I stopped my car. Getting an interview with Greg Floyd wasn't worth my life. I put my car into reverse, and the wheels began to spin. I was stuck. I reached for my cell phone. I had no reception. I was in the dead zone. I had to continue forward. It was the only way I could get out of here. The dog was barking louder now. I drove forward until I found Floyd's run-down log cabin ahead of me. I had come all this way to get this guy's story. I figured I couldn't back down now. I got out of my car and approached the home. I knocked 3 times and waited. My heart was in my throat. I looked over my shoulder for the attack dog, but saw nothing. There was no response at the home, so I left Floyd's front door and returned to my car. As I sped out of there, I had a frightening sense that he'd been watching me from the woods this whole time. Attack dog in one hand, a gun in the other.
December 2007, 7 months after the deadly showdown between Floyd, Lico, and Bruce McKay, Greg Floyd had another dangerous encounter, this time with an elderly neighbor on their shared road. Floyd wouldn't let her pass. "Do you have reverse?" she asked him. "Do you, bitch?" he replied. "Do you want me to pull a gun on you? Because I wouldn't miss." The woman froze. She couldn't leave her vehicle. Floyd eventually left her there, shaking. She called police, and Floyd was arrested for criminal threatening. When interviewed by police, Floyd told them, "She wasn't worth a bullet." Floyd went on trial on April 15, 2008, and for Lico Kenny's family and many in the Franconia community, it was the trial they'd been waiting for a long time. Now, at least, he'd be accountable for something. Extra security was added at the Littleton courthouse when Floyd walked in that day. He was now walking with a cane. Whether he needed it for his health issues or whether it was a visual to endear sympathy from the judge is anyone's guess. The courtroom was packed and tensions were high. "We wish he was going on trial for Lico's murder," many spectators said. Testimony soon got underway. The trial lasted 4 hours. The alleged victim took the stand and was asked by the prosecutor if she was afraid of Floyd. She admitted that she was. "I knew he meant it," she told the court, referring to the deadly threat. "I knew it in my heart."
I was there in the courthouse that day. I approached Floyd before his trial got underway, and he just looked back at me menacingly. The trial broke for a recess in the afternoon. Some observers went out for a cigarette break, while reporters covering the trial placed frantic update calls to their editors. I'd been scribbling notes and needed a place to quietly think. I found a bathroom at the far end of the courthouse, and I entered. I spread my notes across a radiator, and I had my back to the door. I heard it open. I turned and found myself staring at Greg Floyd, and we were alone. "If you want to share your story with me, I'd be glad to hear it," I told him. My invitation set his eyes ablaze. "A man has no rights in this cock-fucking state," he shouted. "Fuck her, fuck the judge, and fuck you." I could do nothing but hold my ground. "Can I quote you on that?" I asked. Floyd reached for his cane and swung it in my direction. I raised my forearm in a defensive posture, and I prayed I'd be strong enough to block the blow. Fortunately for me, the bailiff heard the commotion and demanded that Floyd return to the courtroom. The verdict had come in.
When he returned to the courtroom, Floyd's focus was solely on the judge. "I find the defendant, Gregory Floyd, guilty," the judge declared. "I order Mr. Floyd to serve 12 months in the Grafton County House of Correction." The courtroom erupted with applause. Leeko Kenny's family members even cried. At that moment, Floyd exploded. "You son of a bitch! Do you know what the Constitution is?" he shouted at the judge. Floyd continued to scream. Bailiffs ushered him out of the courtroom, and Floyd resisted defiantly, making no use of his cane. As they tried to subdue him, he threw the doors of the courtroom open violently. A court officer grabbed Floyd, but the ex-Marine struggled to break free. There was a literal free-for-all in the corridor. A journalist and lawyer named Chris King, who dogged the case for years, shouted, "You murdered Leeko Kenny, too! You murdered him, bro!"
The elevator door opened and Floyd was shoved inside. I ran down a flight of stairs to the garage, where a vehicle was revved up, ready to take him to prison. I was the first journalist to arrive in the basement, and my face was the first Greg Floyd saw when the elevator doors opened. He looked at me like he was going to kill me. "I would never help a police officer again," he shouted, referring to Bruce McKay. "The next time I see somebody lying in the road, I'll run over him myself." Officers stuffed Floyd in the waiting police car and left the courthouse with sirens wailing.
After the verdict, everyone in town gathered at the Dutch Treat. The music was loud and the drinks were flowing. It was like New Year's Eve. Everyone at the bar was thinking and talking about Leeko Kenny. "Now we'll see if Kelly Ayotte has the guts to reopen Leeko's case," Chris King told the crowd. His declaration was met by a round of cheers. Surprisingly, Greg Floyd's name was uttered by no one. He was still feared here in the North Country. He was like Lord Voldemort from Harry Potter, "He who shall not be named." As a convicted felon, it was against the law for Floyd to own firearms, but no one at the Dutch Treat thought Floyd would obey the law, even now. "Who knows what kind of arsenal he still has up there," one woman said.
I arrived at the Dutch Treat and ordered a bottle of Sam Adams. I chatted with Chris King, who I had a lot of respect for asking the hard questions in this hard town. Another man approached. His name was Brad Whipple, and he had an investigative background. "Would you like to take a ride?" he asked me. "Where to?" I responded. "Can't tell you that, but I can tell you to bring your camera." I jumped in a car with Whipple and Chris King. The sky over Franconia had turned blood red as the last rays of sunshine dissolved into bleak darkness. Whipple drove over frost heaves on the road where Bruce McKay and Leeko had their final, fateful pursuit. We entered a storage facility, and my curiosity peaked even higher. "What do we have here?" I asked Whipple. "We have the crime scene." He parked the car and fished for a key to open the storage garage. As the door lifted, I took a step forward and then a step back, never taking my eyes off the object in front of me. It was Leeko Kenny's death car. "It looks just like it did the night of the shooting," Whipple told me. "Nothing's changed." I walked to the driver's side window, peered in, and saw Leeko Kenny's dried blood splattered against the headrest and back cushion of the driver's seat. We also examined a small bullet hole at the top of the hood near the windshield and another small hole in the windshield itself. He had told police that he had asked Leeko Kenny several times to drop his gun while sitting in the Celica before he'd been forced to shoot Leeko through the driver's side window. So how come police did not account for the two bullet holes in the windshield? They certainly weren't fired by Bruce McKay. His autopsy showed no powder burns on his hands. No, those bullets were fired by the ex-Marine. Did Greg Floyd play judge, jury, and executioner in the death of Leeko Kenny? If so, here was finally the proof.
While Greg Floyd was held on $20,000 cash bail, prosecutors filed a motion to send him to prison for a longer stretch for violating parole. Instead of 6 to 12 months in jail, Greg Floyd was sent to prison for 3 long years. The people of Franconia now refer to this case as 5/11, a reference to the May 11th date it occurred, the day the fabric of their small mountain community was torn apart, seemingly forever. Bruce McKay's name was added to the National Law Enforcement Memorial in Washington, D.C. in 2008. The fatal shooting of Leeko Kenny remains a closed case in the state of New Hampshire.
This deadly confrontation mirrors the downfall of the famed Old Man of the Mountain, not only in its inevitability, but also the impact it has had on all those around it. Like the old man, one's perception of Bruce McKay, Leeko Kenny, and even Greg Floyd differs depending on where you stand on this case. Law enforcement may remember McKay as a fallen hero, while young, free-thinking men and women look at Leeko Kenny as a fellow searcher in the age of Aquarius. Greg Floyd is even revered by those who believe in guns and their personal freedom. But as William Shakespeare once wrote, "Time is the justice that examines all offenders." As I left Franconia for the last time, I stopped at the village store for a cup of coffee. "You think you'll get much snow this winter?" I asked the store clerk. "We've seen more than our fair share of storms around here," the woman replied. "I know you have," I muttered to myself. "I know."
Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers is a joint production of Mudhouse Media and Fort Point Media. And now, here's legendary bluesman James Montgomery with an original song written and recorded exclusively for this podcast called Old Bad Blood.
Southbound road. He held a bad hand, but he wouldn't fold. And he could see in the mirror something wrong was getting nearer. And old bad blood was about to explode. The law gets broken, is it always a crime? Can a man be a witness if he crosses the line? But the need for law and order sometimes ends up in horror. And bad blood is spilled in just a few minutes' time. Disappeared, no longer guarded either hope or fear. Two men dying, there's no reason why. If you stand your ground, you live
innocence is denied. Can something that's true never be two-sided? When shots ring out in the night and there's no hero in sight, at the end of the road there's gonna be a town divided. Stand your ground, you live free or die. Two men die and there's no reason why. If you stand your ground, you live free or die. Live free or die.
For more podcasts, go to mudhousemedia.com.